Welcome to episode 60 of the Just Jiu-Jitsu podcast. This is Croyler Gracie, here with my host,
Andrew Desimone.
Thank you for joining me, Andrew. I love jiu-jitsu, and I love this podcast. And anyone who listens knows that me, Croyler Gracie, loves Fruity Pebbles. That brings me to our first sponsor of the episode, Fruity Pebbles. When you need to get your fruity rocks off, Fruity Pebbles.
Well, thanks, Croyler. Wow, that was a really good intro. You don't usually do that. Thank you for doing that for me.
That was a great intro. Yeah,
You know what? We're in hard times now, so everyone has to do their part.
Clearly, we need Fruity Pebbles to do their part.
So we are, let's see, about two weeks into our gym being closed. Once we hit Friday, right?
Yep. No, I think it's 2 weeks yesterday, so just over 2 weeks.
So I'm looking at you right now. Oh, first of all, we should start off by saying that we're doing this over video chat.
That's right.
Being very responsible. We're not getting together.
Yeah. Unlike the Grappling Dads who broke protocol and met for their – and they live next door to each other, but it's still not good.
It's still not good because both of them, if you could take a picture of the cliche person to avoid who's filled with sickness and disease, it would be both of those guys.
Yeah. I mean, that's where it probably is going to blow up in Michigan. It's going to be their neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, we try to live by a higher standard, and we are trying to live to keep our community safe, Paul and Kip. And we're video chatting right now, so the sound quality will be a little bit lesser, but oh well, that's the price you pay for this. So 2 weeks in, I'm really surprised to look at you and see that you don't have like blood and shit smeared over your face and like a torn shirt and hole in the drywall behind you. I thought at this point you would have kind of gone insane. Maybe you have. This is the only room in your house that's still intact.
Yeah, I mean, I came upstairs for a reason, and I cleaned up just for you.
Oh, thank you. You put on your best Croyler Gracie Jiu-Jitsu shirt.
I did. It's you got to hide the bodies at this point.
Do you have a favorite Croyler Gracie Jiu-Jitsu shirt?
I don't know. To be fair, I don't buy any shirts, so I just wear what I make or what other people give me.
But the shirts that you've made, what's your favorite one?
Ooh, I think my favorite one was our very, very, very first green one that we made years. It was actually our very first t-shirt. And I think it was more because that was like the first one, you know, but other than that, they're all, you know, good enough.
Was that the one that had the big Confederate flag on it?
No.
That wasn't the one?
None of them had a Confederate flag.
I remember you put that in, we're like, Croyler, listen, we know you're not from around here, but that may not go over well. And you're like, I just like how it looks. We're like, yeah, okay. Not your highest seller.
I don't recall that.
All right. Well, today our episode is a BJJ Heroes episode, or BJJ Giants is what the segment's called. And it is on Marcio Stambowski. So Marcio is someone who you train under. You've been with him for how long now?
I met him 13, almost actually. Wow. It'll be 14 years ago.
So you were like 16, 17-year-old?
Yeah. I think I had just turned 17.
And how did you find him? Because he is based out of Connecticut.
Yeah, well, at the time, he was actually based out of Brazil. He had just moved here, and he went to a tournament that, you know, we happened to have people competing in. It was actually the Nogi Pans, I think, Nogi Pans in New York. And we kind of met there and brought him out to the school to do a seminar. And this was back when I thought that, you know, I knew all jiu-jitsu, and I figured I'm gonna bring this guy out because for years and years and years, you know, when I was training, my goal was just to have this like incredible guard. And I thought I had the best guard in the world at 16. And yeah, which is ridiculous. But, you know, so growing up, I always looked, okay, who are the legends, you know, the guard legends in the world. And his name popped up from several family members. It popped up through old matches I watched. They popped up like everywhere. And I saw the opportunity to do the seminar with him. So he came out to the school, did a seminar, and my thoughts him going into the seminar was that at most I'll learn one or two things, you know, and the rest would be just confirmation of my knowledge. And he blew my mind. You know, the seminar was like 3 hours long, and he pretty much, you know, took, you know, the little bit that I thought was a lot and said, yeah, that's nothing. You don't know anything. He didn't come on and say it, but just showed it through his teaching.
Up until that point, had you trained with anyone who had that big of like an instant impact on you?
No. He, you know, don't get me wrong, I had great teachers growing up, you know, I had great family members that had good knowledge and taught well and all that, but he didn't come out to prove it that he knew more or that he knew better. He just came out to teach, and I don't know, it blew my mind. It's hard to explain.
And what's the connection between you guys? How did a 16-year-old Corraler get him to this legend to come to your Elkhart school?
He is, he's married to, I'm actually, there's a bunch of different connections prior to him and I hooking up. He is married to Carla Gracie. He married her a long while ago. I think they've been married for over 35 years. Carla is technically my cousin, second cousin. I think it'd be in English, should be second cousin. She is Carlos Gracie's granddaughter. And, you know, he married into the family. He's got Deborah and Neiman. Deborah Stavosky and Neiman Gracie are his kids. And they're both black belts. They train, they teach. Neiman is in Bellator. So there's a connection through the family side where, you know, we're family. Mm-hmm. Right. And then there's the connection through my dad as well. When I think 97 or 98, 1997, 1998, he went to Fortaleza in Brazil. And that's the town that my dad used to teach jiu-jitsu at. And he came in and he asked if he could train there. And, you know, my dad welcomed him and they became friends.
Did your dad know instantly who he was?
No. So he you know, Marcio has always been a legend in the sport. He's always been one of these guys that, you know, he was just a legend. Like if you beat him, like if you even in training, getting the better of him would be like gigantic for you. And he came into my dad's school and he said he trained a little bit of jiu-jitsu and he asked if he could train here while he was visiting for work. My dad said, of course. My dad had actually trained with him years ago or a few years prior to that. He just didn't recognize him. And, one of my dad's students came and got him and said, hey, you know, this visitor, whoever he is, he's like, you know, just destroying everyone. And so my dad, you know, this was back in Brazil where, you know, gym reputation mattered and stuff. And my dad got up there, my dad was watching him and he was like, hey man, he's like, are you Macajon? You know, like, are you Marcio Macajon? And he's like, yeah, man. And basically, you know, my dad's like, oh my God, how come in here saying you trained a little bit of jiu-jitsu, you know? And, you know, they had trained before, so they're training partners and it's very tough not to be Marcio's friend. And, yeah, so they hooked up there and, you know, he knew my dad, he knew my mom. You know, it was one of those things where it was like very easy to find a connection with him.
So as you were searching for a person to bring in and or a person to kind of really take on not necessarily as a mentor. Were you saying like, I want a mentor, or I just want someone? Was it just a one-off? I just want someone to come in and have a good seminar. And then as when he was there, it was so.
Well, the original idea was to have him come out and teach us stuff. You know, I thought, like I said, I thought I knew everything when I was 16. And I figured if he comes in, he teaches a seminar, I will pick out one or two things that maybe I didn't know. I might pick out a few tricks that he may have due to experience.
Knowing you, you probably thought, I'll even teach him maybe a thing or two. I could show him
something. No, I didn't think that. No. But I thought, you know, everybody, all the students will definitely get something out of it. But for me, like on a very selfish level, it was just, how does my knowledge base compare, you know, like at least with guard related things. And it didn't compare, you know, like I felt like the Joe Schmuck down the road who's never trained jiu-jitsu, you know.
And that was your first time meeting him. What was your, besides the seminar, what was just your impression of the guy when you met him?
He's like the happiest guy to be around. You know, he's everybody's friend. He's got the super charisma. He's got this happy aura about him that just makes you happy, you know, to be near him. And you know, he was great. Like I said, it blew my mind. He flew home that weekend. He just came in like on a Friday and left on a Sunday. And I think like by the following Wednesday or Thursday, I called him and I said, hey, can I come out and train? So I don't have any money, you know, I'll fly out and I have money to fly out, but that's about it. You know, like I'll crash at the school if you are okay with that. And, you know, well, what can I do? Essentially is what it came out to. And he's like, oh, just come out. He's like, you know, we'll figure something out. Just come out and visit. That'll be fine. And it was great. Like I flew out to see him and he came and picked me up at the airport and gave me a big old hug. And he's like, oh, get in the car. He's like, let's go into town. And we had like an hour and a half drive back to his place. And then he's like, hey, do you want to train like right now? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I just flew in, but like,
yeah, training after a flight is always fun.
Yeah. I'm like, yeah, I mean, I went in with the mentality of, you know, anything he asks me to do, I'll do, because it means training and it means improvement, you know? And, so we talked about a lot of different things, and about halfway home, he started calling some people and he's like, hey, I got a guy here for you guys to train with. Just come on out. You know, come on, train and, you know, it'll be good. And I flew in on like on a Sunday cause it was cheaper. So it wasn't even like a regular like training day. And anyway, so we get to the school and it's all these like, brown belts, you know, brown belts that were there. He didn't have any black belts at the time. He had one black belt that avoided me, but there's all these brown belts that were there. And he's like, oh, these are the tougher guys at the school. You know, he's like, just roll hard with them, you know? And basically like I was pulling the ring for, you know, an hour and a half, however long it was. These guys would go with me until I got, you know, a submission or they got a submission, and then they would rotate out and somebody fresh would come in, and I never got out of the center. So
was he rolling or was he just watching?
He was just watching. He never even put the gi on. He just watched. And we got done. Those guys got done about an hour and a half later. And he's like, let's go get some food. And we got in the car. I was all sweaty. And he's like, let's go get some food. And one of his students called and said, hey, you know, I'm playing at this like jazz pub thing, you know, come out. So we went there and we had like, we were there for like half an hour. And then Marcia's like, yeah, I'm not quite feeling it. Let's go somewhere else. So we went and got some Peruvian food instead. And then went back to his house. He had a little house, a tiny little house. And, you know, I basically slept on a cot and he had, you know, went to bed. And next morning, like 5 o'clock, he woke me up and he's like, let's go train. And that was my routine pretty much every day for that summer. I was there an entire summer.
So in that tiny house, did that hold him, Carla, Neiman, and Deborah?
No, at the time it was just him and I. Neiman came with him, and I think they were here for about 3 to 5 months before I ran into Marcio. At the time they were living together, but then Neiman moved to New York to go train with Hanzo and his cousins that were there, and you know, our cousins that were there. And so Marcio was actually kind of by himself at the time, which was a lucky break for me because it meant that, you know, he wanted the company and that there was a place for me to sleep. Because the alternative would be to sleep on the floor or sleep on the mats, which was just fine. You know, it never bothered me. So
what kind of stuff did you guys, just the two of you, do when you're hanging out in this little house in Connecticut?
Oh, well, we talked a lot about like philosophies and different things, you know, different approaches to teaching and how, you know, what an instructor means and what an instructor should be. We played a lot of chess. He's actually like a really good chess player. So we played a lot of chess together. We watched a lot of old fights, broke down a lot of old fights. He had like VHSs that he brought with him from Brazil, and we sat down and kind of went through them. He pulled up a lot of old videos that he didn't have on YouTube, and we watched those and kind of broke that down. But man, like training with him, it wasn't like we had a lot of time at home. You know, he'd get up, he'd get me up around 5 and get dressed, out the door by like 5:20, 5:30, and get to the school by 5:45. And you know, he has a morning class at 6. By the time he had a morning class at 6, he had one at like 11, one at 5, 6, 7, 8 p.m. And then, you know, I attended every class. And between the group classes, he had all these private classes. And I was essentially the dummy for the private classes, which was great because it gave me a lot of exposure to him teaching, not just group classes, but private classes, and exposure to his knowledge, to like all the different positions and techniques that he was teaching people, because not every student was learning the same thing. It gave him a break as far as his body goes. He didn't have to abuse his body as much. He didn't have to be the dummy for every private class, you know? So it wasn't like if he taught like an ankle lock, people were ankle locking him, you know, 30 times in a private. So, and then anytime somebody wanted to roll, he could rest and I would come in and I would roll. So I got a lot of rolling time, a lot of exposure to technique, a lot of exposure to different classes. It was a really great time. And then his last class ended at like 9 p.m. And then we would go to the like a local produce store and get some fruit, go home, have dinner, and then go to bed, rinse and repeat.
Yeah. How long was your first, was that first summer out there? Were you there for the whole summer?
Yeah, I was there pretty much for the whole summer. I think I got there somewhere around May. I think his seminar was, I think, end of February, beginning of No, I think his seminar was in March, and then end of March, and then May I was done with school. End of May I was done with school, and I just flew out and saw him. I was there pretty much the whole summer.
So when you came back from that trip, what was your? I'm sure you learned a ton of stuff. Were there a couple main like takeaways? Like what stuck with you the most after that first stint with him?
How he approached teaching and relationship with students was very different. I started teaching when I was very young, you know. I shouldn't have been teaching, you know. I started teaching when I was, first time I taught a group class for adults was I was like 12 years old. And growing up that way, it made me think that the only way people would respect me enough to learn from me would be to beat them. So like from 12 to 16, 17, my mentality was if I didn't think you and I both were very aware that I could beat you, that you would challenge me and that you wouldn't want to learn from me. And I was, you know, obviously insecure and I didn't believe that. So
did that work the other way where you thought if someone could beat you, then you couldn't teach them?
I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure. I don't think I ever explicitly thought that way, but yeah, I thought maybe other people wouldn't want to learn from me then. you know? So I used to think of my students as people that I competed against. I would still teach them. I wanted them to succeed, but every role to me was like a tournament role, you know, like it was a tournament match, every role. And I was merciless, you know, and I didn't really care how people felt after a role or if their arm or their neck hurt, you know. It was just like, it was a mission. And after spending that summer with him, you know, through actions, I'm sure through conversation, you know, the idea was, you know, the ability to beat somebody is great, but it fades. It fades over time. You get sick, you get injured, you get old. So people don't want to learn from you because you can beat them. They want to learn from you because they think you can make them better, you know? And one thing that Marcio did consistently, still does to this day consistently, is he is friends with everyone. Everybody that comes into school, he's friends with. He learns about them, you know, their lives on and off the mats. He pays attention to them, focuses on them. And then people don't question him. They don't challenge him. There's no weird, like, mentality or behavior. So when I came back, I thought, hey, you know, I'm still going to roll serious with my students and I'm still going to roll hard with them, but it doesn't have to be a tournament roll every time. I don't have to crank every armbar. I don't have to hold every choke. You know, I don't have to have people aching and in pain after every day.
Now you just do that. I don't have want to.
Right. Now it's just fun.
Right.
No. And, you know, I made a point coming back to make an effort on being friends with my students. And it wasn't so much like, it wasn't conscious. It wasn't like, well, I got to be friends with Andrew. And like, I like hyper-focused on Andrew to be his friend. It was just one of those things was like, don't shut myself off, which I used to do, you know, because if I had to compete with these people, I couldn't be really their friends, you know?
Okay.
So it was more just, you know, just open yourself up, you know, just have fun. If people want to grab food with you after the class, go grab it with them. And if you're bored, go watch a movie with them, you know, text them, call them, you know, just have a friendship, have a communication with everybody. And that caused a great shift in my thinking. Because now I didn't have to prove to people I was better. They sought me out, you know, because they all knew I knew more. They all wanted to learn from me. But now they didn't feel like I was the enemy. They didn't feel like I was this guy that beat the shit out of them just because he could.
Mm-hmm. So let's step back and look at Marcio, the man, and kind of some of his history, his backstory. He is born in 59, so that'd make him 61. He is a red and white belt, eighth degree. What are the requirements to get to that level?
Well, you know, once you get your black belt, truly the degrees in your black belt are just a time marker. You know, how much time have you put into it? Truly, you know, more than anything else. And to get to the point where you're an eighth degree black belt and you are basically a candy cane belt, you know, where it's white and red.
When does it get to candy cane? What degree?
It's an eighth degree. Yeah.
Okay.
So after this is red, so it just becomes red after this. I mean, at this stage, you have to put in so much time of your life, you know, to put in perspective. Every degree in your black belt is 3 years until the third degree. So it's 9 years for the first three, and then you have 5 years for the next three. So you're 24 to get to six. And I believe it's 7, 8, and 9 at that point. So, so he put 7 to get a 7. So that's 31. And then 8 on top of that, I think I'll have to go back and check the official IBJJF ruling. They change slightly how they do the
All that to say, he's been a black belt for well over 30 years.
Yeah, longer than you and I have been alive. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Been a black belt, just a black belt, not training.
I know.
But a black belt.
That blows my mind. I was like, just reading about him. I was looking at pictures, and it's weird to see pictures of like him and other guys who are just old black and white photos. And it's not, you're not looking at it saying, oh, this is right, this is when he started. No, he already had the black belt at that point.
He's a
black belt, and then we're still taking black and white pictures.
Yes, it's insane. And you know, he's one of these guys that he doesn't gloat about his rank. You know, he's one of the highest ranked guys in all of BJJF. He's probably one of the highest ranked people in the world. You know, definitely top 15 in the world. So it's one of those things where it's like, you talk to him though, he'll talk to like some regular guy who has not dedicated his life to something, you know?
Yeah. When you first meet him when I first talked to him, I was nervous at first. I thought, oh, this is a guy who has a ton of respect. And it took about 10 to 20 seconds of talking to him to then just ease into a very comfortable conversation where it feels like a guy who, it's just a guy you could have met off the street. He doesn't have a chip on his shoulder. He doesn't demand that you treat him with like this severe respect. He's just a laid back, cordial guy.
Right. Yeah. He you know, there was something that, he said on his ceremony when he got his candy cane belt that was kind of stuck with me. You know, he said, it's really nice to be here with my teammates, because a lot of the people that got their black belts from Holes roughly at the same time all got promoted roughly at the same time. And he said, it's really nice to be here with my teammates. You know, these guys are pretty much brothers to me. We've been training together for over 40 years. It's really nice that to be recognized and to have gotten to this point, because it's like becoming jiu-jitsu. So, you know, and it's very true. Like when you dedicate your life to jiu-jitsu, like he has, like you're not getting a new belt. You're not getting a new degree. No, you just are jiu-jitsu. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, he's done jiu-jitsu longer than he's done anything else in his life other than breathing. You know, if you think about it.
Yeah. So he was born in, like we said, 59. He has an interesting story where he was born to a Holocaust survivor in his mother. His dad was Russian. He then moved to Brazil where Marcio was born. Actually, I don't remember if Marcio was born in Brazil or.
He was born in Brazil.
He was. He's the highest ranking Jewish jiu-jitsu.
He's the highest ranking Jew out of any martial art.
Yeah. And I mean, you look at the stuff that he's done. Oh, not to forget, he's also a brown belt in judo.
Yes.
So, I mean, yes. Just, at that point, you're just showing off.
Right. Yeah. Why? It's unnecessary.
His nickname. Makahau. What is that? Why does he have that nickname?
Makahau means like pasta, like noodle or spaghetti, you know? and it was a nickname they gave him, I think even before he started training. I think it was actually his brother's nickname, and I think his friends started calling him that and it kind of stuck. My guess is because of his build, you know, he's very long and lanky. But I think it was a nickname his brother had, and when he was his brother was surfing, and he surfs too. He's a big surfer, and I think, you know, in that culture, nicknames kind of fly around, and it's stuck. And his friends start calling him that, then his team start calling him that, and it just stuck with him.
If you had a nickname, a pasta nickname, which noodle would you be?
Oh, I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, what noodle are you thinking?
I have no idea. That's not a question I've given zero thought to this.
Let's okay.
What
let me
pasta
try. To think
should
of.
I be
here? I'll think of one for you. You think of one for me. Okay.
I think this is a dangerous game.
Here, all right. I'll go first, and then you, I'll give you some time to think. I think you were going to be spinach stuffed ravioli.
That's like really in depth.
Yeah, because you got a lot of nutrients inside you, but you're like on the outside, people are like, he's a little rough. I don't think I like him. I don't want to get to know this guy. He's got some like rough, rippled edges. I don't know. And then they get to know you and you just got this soft, cheesy, spinachy inside.
I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah. All right, go ahead. All right, let's hear it.
I'm still not giving a lot of thought.
You know what? I'll give my own one.
All right.
Angel hair. Just very soft and delicate and elegant. Elegant.
Sure.
Elegant. Elegant, yeah.
Yeah, I could go with that.
Angel hair, cool.
I could second that. Yeah.
All right. That's our nickname.
I'm not going to call you that, though. I'm not going to call you that now, but.
You don't want to call me Angel hair.
No, I think I'd feel very disturbed.
When we're like out somewhere, like with friends, you could be like, hey, Angel hair. Oh, Angel hair, this guy over here.
Yeah, I don't know if I could do that. I might do that just to fuck with you now.
Like, stop it. Stop it, ravioli.
Oh, goddamn.
All right, moving on to more important things. Huge claim to fame is he trained under Holes Gracie.
Right.
And was part of
one of the five black belts.
Which, explain what the famous five is.
So, Holes Gracie only awarded five black belts while he was alive. He died, you know, a tragic accident early on. And of those five, Marcio is obviously one of them. And those five guys have all achieved, like, some pretty incredible feats in the jiu-jitsu community. So like, even though Holes is a legend in the sport, you know, almost mythical, they went on all to achieve great, great things. You know, Carlos Gracie was one of Holes' black belts. He's the head of Gracie Baja, the head of IBJJF. You know, Mauricio Gomez is Hasha Gracie's dad, runs one of the biggest associations in England, in the UK. You know, you have Jacare, the original Jacare, who is the head of Alliance. You know, you have Marcio. So it's one of those things where these guys are all able to do like incredible things, even though, you know, their mentor wasn't around.
Yeah. And from what I read, when Holes passed away, Marcio took a break for a while from jiu-jitsu to train judo. And I think that's when, I don't know if he got his brown belt then, but it sounded like he just left and strictly did judo for a while.
Yeah. I mean, Holes' death, like, took a really big toll on Marcio. I mean, that's how Marcio met his wife, you know. He met her through Holes, and it really crushed Marcio. I think he couldn't bear the thought of training jiu-jitsu with somebody else, or even learning from somebody else, because of the respect he had for his master, you know. I think that, you know, it was one of those things where emotionally, maybe spiritually, he wasn't ready to do. You know, to him, Holes was like this older brother, this dad-like figure, you know, I mean, like, that, you know, was there through a lot of Marcio's, like, difficult times, you know, that we all have when we're teenagers and stuff. And he was, like, suddenly taken away like that in a disaster. So, I do believe that his break or his pause was to, you know, and I can't speak for him, but I think it was a way to still train, but not be such an emotional, like, challenging task, you know?
Yeah. So he did jiu-jitsu for a little while. I'm sorry, judo for a while. Now, he did compete. I'm hopping back now, but he did compete. What was his competition career like?
Oh, he did really well. As far as I know, he lost very few matches. He generally tend to win. He lost, I think, once to Hoyler in the finals. And I think once was a referee's decision to Hickson. It was like a weird withdrawal situation. But overall, I think he was a highly successful competitor. He's got some matches. It's crazy. I've seen some footage in his house. He's got matches that were like an hour and a half long. It was crazy. You know, just like longer than it takes to listen to this podcast. He was actively grappling somebody else.
Although sometimes I think people would say that this podcast feels like it's a lot longer than that.
I haven't heard anybody say that. I'm not going to bite.
I don't send those emails to you. That's why.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Helps my self-esteem.
Exactly. I mean, you got that cheesy, spinachy inside. So I got to keep that.
Oh my God. Oh, you know, it's a good thing that we're doing this from like different towns.
What did Marcio bring to jiu-jitsu? What is he known for? I know there's some things that he did as far as like techniques.
As far as like specific techniques, people know him for the Makahama sweep, which is he created it. He won't tell you that. You can ask him like straight to his face and he'll say he didn't create it. He learned it from holes and that he just, you know, polished it a little bit. He will never take credit for it, but the Makahama sweep is a highly effective sweep from close guard when an opponent stands up. And
how do you spell it for people who are going to try to look it up?
It's Makarraao sweep.
Okay.
But you know, he essentially created, developed, perfected it. It's a hyper efficient sweep, and in fact, people are so ridiculous. Like they don't know their history. You know, one of my friends, his name is Jay Mansfield, is a black belt in Port City, and Port City, New Hampshire. Anyways, he said something in a camp that we taught together one year that was really good and really hit home. He said, "It's so ridiculous to think that we have created anything, that we need to understand that we are practitioners now. We have developed on the work that giants have set forth. You know, like we are being raised up on their
like we stand on the shoulders of giants."
Yeah, yeah, and basically, it's true because I saw a video the other day. Actually, Dr. House sent it to me, and he said, "LOL." And it was like a facepalm, and it was some Instagram handle had posted a video of a guy doing the Makahama sweeping competition, and it said "new sweep, fresh out of the lab," and I was like, "Get the fuck out of here!" You know, it's been around for like 40 years, but you know, people they all want to rebrand and sell themselves, you know, and don't understand that some of these things are. They've been around forever, and here you have the guy who created this stuff, and you can flat out ask him like, "Did you create this?" And he's like, no, I just, you know, I learned it, you know? So I think that's a big difference, and that tells you a lot about somebody, that they don't take the credit for the things that they're good at, whereas somebody else may be trying to steal that credit, you know?
Right. It's kind of like, you don't take credit for a lot of the TikTok dance trends that come out. You see people do these dances over and over in different iterations of it, and you never will admit to being the source of them. And I can't say how much I respect that.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you respect that. I don't think I even have the TikTok app on my phone.
you've said that enough now that we all know that's not true. I think you're protesting a little too much.
Sure. Other things that Marcy, the one thing that
change the subject. Convenient.
Yeah, I did. one of the things that Marcio is really known for is triangles, right? So in judo, triangles were, generally speaking, a more of a defensive, less ditch, Hail Mary kind of effort. Because in judo, if there's a level change, the opponents have to stand up, they have to be reset. So triangling in judo is very inefficient unless your opponent is turtled. And Marcio, again, he won't take any credit for it, but Marcio took what was a Hail Mary, a opportunistic technique, and he made it into the hyper-effective weapon that's now iconic to jiu-jitsu. You know, today, triangles are offensive as well as defensive, and there's triangles from everywhere. And, you know, this is highly influenced by Marcio Stambowski.
What kind of stuff did he bring to the triangle game? Are there little twists that
everything from setups to technical efficiency, you know? We did the episode where we talked about mechanical versus technical, like, strength, you know? You know, a lot of people think that a triangle is just squeezing with your legs, but the reality is the way he teaches it.
Squeezing with your butt, right?
Right. No. The way he teaches, he looks to eliminate space. He creates the right angles. Before he ever puts any sort of muscular power into it, he's eliminated every space and he's tightening every angle. You can't move because you're mechanically inefficient. And he can then, once you're completely disarmed and pretty much, you know, ready to hang, he just kicks the chair out of under you, you know, and I think that's different than most people that just try to squeeze and make it happen, make it work, you know.
I was reading also about his contributions, and some people are saying he contributed a lot to closed guard. What kind of stuff did he do for closed guard? I knew about the triangle. I knew about his sweep. Are there things with the closed guard that come to mind?
Yeah. I'm a big closed guard guy myself, and every time I visit him, and he happens to show a technique from closed guard, I'm learning from him. Like, he's got all these like little tricks, from simple things like grip breaking to chaining several attacks together, so that, you know, even if the first one fails, it doesn't matter. It's that failure is the first step for the next technique, and it's like this endless cycle of attacks. You know, he's relentless with how he attacks, and it's not necessarily like relentless as in like physically, like he's like physically attacking you, but it's like your mind and your body can't ever, you know, get a break because he's still setting up more traps, and you know, he's pushing you. It's like, it's the same thing when you play chess with him. It's not that he's doing it, the checkmate in three moves, is that you're constantly playing under, you know, quote unquote check, you know? So you always have to behave in a certain way, and it makes you predictable and easy to beat. And in his closed guard, that's pretty much all he does. And he's got, on top of that, this incredible game, incredible timing. He's got the perfect body for guard work. You know, he's long and flexible. And I mean, like, he is 6'5", 6'6", even though he may not admit it, you know, and he's pretty much all legs.
Yeah. And his school is in Connecticut. What is the name of his school?
Gracie Sports.
Gracie Sports. And he has a couple affiliates too, right?
Yeah, he's got two schools. He's got his headquarters in Norwalk, and then he's got another one. I believe his other school is,
is it the one he just opened?
The one he just opened. I actually haven't been able to go there yet.
Does his daughter run that gym? Deborah?
Yeah, Deborah runs that school, yeah. Fairfield. The other school is Fairfield.
Who, Deborah, she's one of the two only female Gracie black belts, right?
Yes, Deborah is the second Gracie woman to get a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. And there's only two of them, Kira and her, and I think she's the second.
How old is she?
So her,
younger, she, younger than you?
She's older than me, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she's, I think, a couple of years older than me. But So they have the school in Norwalk, and that's the headquarters for Gracie Sports. Then Deborah runs a satellite school in Fairfield, and then they have, you know, maybe half a dozen to 10 schools that are affiliated with them.
And then his son, Neiman Gracie, is fighting in Bellator.
Yeah, he trains at Henzo's school. I think he teaches at Henzo's as well. And Neiman is probably one of the best MMA fighters, you know, pound for pound, you know, in any circuit.
All right, so as we wrap this up, what should people, when people think of Marcia, what should they think of? What does he stand for? What does he do? What's his two-sentence summary for jiu-jitsu when you think of Marcio Stambowski?
He's probably one of the greatest minds in jiu-jitsu, and he's humble enough that you would never know it.
That's high praise. I like that. What's my contribution to jiu-jitsu in two sentences?
You know, probably this podcast.
That's one sentence. You get one more.
Oh. I don't know. I think you do a really good job of taking, you know, I always claim that I'm like a little guy in a big body, but you show that.
Oh, so. Wow. Dude, that was a compliment. You hear that, everyone? That was a compliment coming out of his mouth. And I could see his face, and it actually, he wasn't cringing when he said that.
It's probably because I'm losing my mind because I haven't been outside in forever.
It's true. Have you run out of food yet? Have you started eating drywall and like couch cushions yet?
Not quite there yet.
You still have a couple.
But the neighbor's cat might be next though.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the neighbor's next, but the cat, then the neighbor.
Sure. You assume the neighbor's still there.
That's true. You do like animals more than people. So
yeah.
Well, let's see here. Let's end with we haven't done a Croiler's Corner in a while, so we'll do a Croiler's Corner.
What is that again?
it's just like I asked a couple questions. They could be serious.
Oh God.
Stupid. You never know. I think I had a theme song. I don't remember it though. So we'll give you the, it's dealer's choice. What do you want? What kind of genre of music do you want your theme song to be?
How would I know? What kind of question is that?
I'll ask you again. What kind of genre do you want your music to be?
My music? Or what do you mean, like my theme song?
Yeah, your theme song. Just your intro.
Are you going to sing it?
Yes. Yeah, of course I'll sing it.
All right, then I want like opera.
No, you said opera last time.
Oh, okay. All right.
I know you listen to music other than opera, you fucking weirdo.
let's do like hard rock.
Okay.
Well, this is Croiler's Corner. Croiler's Corner. We're gonna see what he has to say about all the funny things today. Croiler's Corner. Boom, boom, boom. Put your learning hat on.
All right.
Wow, you actually like, you got like really red doing that.
Yeah. I fostered my inner
Steve. Like, yeah, like you hear that, Steve?
No, he stopped listening long ago.
No, okay. No, I'll have to send him a shout out.
Yeah. All right, so we'll start off with your first question. What's your fondest memory of your grandpa? And my memory of you, like your interaction with him, not just one that like you've heard.
Oh, he woke me up. We always used to get up and kind of help around the house and around the farm and stuff. And I remember I got up one morning and I decided to go walk the horse, one of the horses. And I thought I was super cool because I got up before he did. And I got up before he did because my grandfather used to wake people up with a glass of juice. Like that was breakfast, you know, like this big, like fruit smoothie thing. And I got up and there wasn't anything on my bedside desk. So I assumed that, yeah, I woke up before him. So I snuck out and got on the horse and I'm walking the horse and I'm like, okay, I'm just going to walk the horse. I'm supposed to just walk it, not run it, you know? And I was probably like 8 or 9. And, my grandfather had a lot of dogs around the property for security. And, not that our house ever needed protecting, but nonetheless.
And he was a dog groomer too for a while, right? He'd style.
No, he was never a dog groomer. No. But he had 7 Brazilian fillets. They're very big, big dogs. They're like big mastiffs. And they're in chains around the house to kind of protect the perimeter of the house. But anyway, so I'm riding this horse, but we're just walking. And the horse got spooked by one of the dogs and it took off, you know? So I'm on the horse and this horse is just like flying around the property, you know, and as a very attentive and careful 8 or 9 year old, I lose the reins. So now this horse is just flying all over the place, does whatever it wants, whenever it wants. And I have no control over this horse. And I decided, I was like, you know, I'm going to jump out of the horse on the grass because it's going to be soft at least. And this was right around the time when, you know, Superman broke his back and it was this huge thing in Brazil.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I got to do it, you know, on the grass. Cause if I fall on concrete, I'm going to be just like him. It's going to be horrible. And I had all these things running. And then the horse ran through this rose bush and that was like far up and it scratched up my face. It cut my face up, you know, the thorns. When I finally realized what had just happened and I realized I was bleeding, now the horse is running on pavement, you know, and on the long driveway that we had. So now I'm like, you know, in my 8 or 9 year old mind, can't jump now, you know, like if I fall, I'm going to break my back too. And my grandpa like appeared like a ghost out of nowhere and like put his hand out and the horse just stopped like immediately, like just stopped. My grandpa and this horse had like this weird bond. It was very strange. Yeah, he just put his hand out, you know, and the horse just immediately stopped moving. My grandpa walked up to the horse, got the reins, looked at me, said, go inside. And that was it. And I remember thinking like, oh man, I'm in so much trouble. You know, here I was trying to do something cool, you know, for my grandpa and I messed up. And he never said a word, you know, he just let me sweat it out. And a few days later, you know, he was like, next time you ride the horse, you hold the reins. And that was it. Like, there was no, like, you're an idiot. There was no judgment. It was just, he got that I was trying to do something. He also understood that I messed up and he basically let me think on the problem first. And then he just said, you know, this is the solution. No.
The only way that story would have been better is if there would have been a girl that you were talking to and trying to impress and then hopped on the horse and she saw all of this happen.
No, I was 8 or 9. Okay. That did not happen.
All right. Let's do, if you could do a private with anyone living or dead, who would it be?
Private? Who? Oh, I don't know, man. That's a tough question.
Can't be someone you've done a private with, so you can't say like Marcio.
That's really tough because it depends what I'm looking to get out of that private. I mean, how long is a private?
You get an hour. An hour, you know, private? You get 2 hours and it's just a one-time thing.
Oh, so it's one and done. Like this could never happen again.
One and done, 2 hours.
Well, like
Ashton Kutcher, I heard he's like a blue belt or something, isn't he?
He's a brown belt.
Oh, brown belt. Okay, all right. There you go.
Brown belt. Yeah. Man, if it could be a one and done, and like it could never happen again, then there's a couple people that come to mind. You know, I would have to really think about it because there's like the athlete in me would have certain people that they would rather learn from, but the teacher in me would have other people that I would want to learn from, You know, like an athlete. I don't know.
If you did the athlete, who would it be?
I'd probably go like John Donahue.
Okay.
I think he takes a very practical approach to teaching. He removes everything, kind of sticks to the essentials. Him or Marcelo Garcia. Marcelo Garcia would be another one I would love to do.
Wait, for the athlete or for the teaching, say?
For the athlete.
What about the teaching, yeah, if you went down the teaching route?
For the teaching, you know, I would like to, you know, do something like with Hoyler or Horian Gracie. They're both very, very good instructors, very underrated instructors. Hickson would be a very underrated instructor as well.
All right. Then last question. If you were in a dark alley, this is from a friend of ours, Patrick. He said, if you're in a dark alley and you see a gang of coronavirus approaching you, how would you fight them off?
A gang of coronavirus?
Yep.
What does that mean? It's like, it's just virus floating in the air, or is it people that are infected?
It's been around long enough. It's evolved. So it can, it doesn't need host bodies anymore. It can take the form of like enough of a form to wear leather jackets and have switchblades.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you see some coronavirus, and it's coming towards you. I mean, how do you fight that off?
Well, I don't ever get sick. So, you know, I would have no problem, you know, walking right through it.
Incorrect. The correct answer would have been ginseng and chamomile tea.
Noted. I'll keep that in mind. I'll even post it on Facebook so that people that are currently infected, they know the right solution.
Yeah. That's, I don't know why people are freaking out. Those two things together.
That should be the hashtag. What is it? Ginseng and what?
Ginseng and chamomile.
There you go.
And if that doesn't work, burn some sage also. That helps.
Okay. All right. I'll keep that in mind.
All right. Well, this was a good first try on Zoom. I think that's successful as long as when I hit the stop button here, it doesn't just completely erase. So I think...
Well, if it erases, we'll just try again.
Yeah. All right. Well, Croyler Gracie, thank you for joining us today. And stay healthy. And is there anything you want to say?
Oh, yeah. This is Ravioli signing off.
Oh, man.
That's what I sound like.
I love those characters that you do sometimes.
Wow. Okay.
All right.
All right. Bye.
Bye.